Those people who aren't taking sleep seriously are really missing out on the most potent performance-enhancing drug out there.
Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann. I'm the founder and editor of sleepjunkies.com, and we cover the whole conversation on sleep. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about exercise and fitness and sports and how these topics fit into the world of sleep. So in the last few years and the last couple of decades, there's been a radical rethinking in the world of professional sports and athletics, and how, in terms of how the athletes and also the coaches and the managers now view sleep as a serious performance enhancing factor. And most of this is because there's been so much new research that's come out telling the benefits of why sleep is really important for physiological recovery, for motivation. If you're not getting enough sleep, you're more prone to injury, and many, many other factors. And today we're going to take a look at these topics, but we also want to apply this not just to professional athletes, but also to anyone who does any type of exercise. We're going to take a look at this bi-directional relationship, whereby if you're not getting enough sleep, then your exercise is going to suffer. And conversely, if you're exercising without any regard to your sleep, if you're exercising at the wrong time of day, for instance, then potentially that can have an impact on your sleep. So these two topics are very, very closely intertwined, and we're going to take a high-level overview of this whole subject, and we're going to be talking to a scientist and a researcher who has studied sleep but has also competed in many different sports over the years. That's enough for the introduction. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review. You can also check us out on social. We're all over Twitter, we're on Instagram, we've got a Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide. And of course, you can visit us at the website, sleepjunkies.com. Okay, let's get on with the show.
Well, good afternoon. I'm joined today with Dr. Amy Bender, all the way from Canada. You're in Toronto, I believe, today, Amy. Originally, you're from the States, but you reside in Calgary. Is that right?
Yes. I'm originally from Spokane, Washington. I live in Calgary. I lived in Canada the past 4 years. And then now I'm actually in Toronto doing a couple of talks here. Yes, I'm all over.
And you're talking about the same subject we're talking about today, which is a subject that's pretty hot at the moment. A lot of people talking about this. And we're going to talk about exercise and fitness and how that affects sleep. And Amy, I think you're extremely well qualified to talk about this subject, because not only have you got a background in sleep science and research, but also I believe you're quite a sporty family and you've been involved in quite a lot of different sports yourself.
That is correct. I grew up with four brothers, so I was the fourth out of five, and they gravitated towards sports. So did I. My older brothers had me playing goalie for them while they kicked balls, you know, practiced their soccer shots, had me rebound baskets for them so they could practice their shooting. And so I really looked up to them, and sports became a passion of mine. I played a number of sports in high school, kind of settled on basketball, and ended up playing college basketball, was inducted into the Hall of Fame at the community colleges of Spokane. After school, took a mountaineering course, so I summited a number of volcanoes and did an Ironman in 2009. And now I'm currently chasing around my three children who are six yeah. and under. Those are my hobbies. Yeah.
And then you found yourself following this career in sleep as well. Can you talk us through that and where you are now?
Sure. I started off, I guess, attending my aunt's sleep lab. So she invited me out there. She's a sleep technologist, so she scores the sleep record. She hooks up patients with electrodes. I went out there. I got to see all the physiological signals. So the brain waves, the breathing, the muscle activity, the eye movements. And I was pretty much hooked. I ended up volunteering at a sleep lab in Spokane. And as it turned out, there was an open sleep technologist position at the new lab at the Sleep and Performance Research Center, headed by Greg Belenke and Hans van Dongen, and ended up getting world-class training there as a sleep technologist. Then wanted to do graduate school, so I did my master's and PhD there, focusing on sleep EEG, and really wanted to combine both of my passions for sport and sleep. And so ended up doing a postdoc at the University of Calgary, working with Canadian Olympic team athletes and optimizing their sleep. So I was able to work with the curling team, the rowing team, the speed skating team, and then just a number of athletes from various different sports, screening them for sleep problems, but then also finding ways to optimize sleep in those athletes.
Awesome, awesome. Generally, could you frame and summarize this idea about sleep being a vital part of any fitness regime, whether you're a competitive athlete, competitive sports person, or whether you just want to keep fit? Maybe you want to lose weight, maybe you just want to have some kind of regular exercise in your life. But the bottom line is, if you discount sleep and think sleep's not important, that's going to have a big impact on how effective your workout's going to be, your training is going to be. And it works the other way around as well. If you structure your exercise the wrong way, that's going to affect your sleep. So I just wondered if you could just briefly summarize that, and then we'll dive into some of those specific aspects in a bit.
Yes, we know sleep is so important for an athlete or someone trying to, you know, improve their fitness in general. With poor sleep, we see effects on mood. And so if you're not getting the 7 to 9 hours, you're not going to really feel like working out necessarily the next day. If you're continuing to get 6 or less hours day in and day out, you're not going to have that energy. Your mood is going to be impacted. We know endurance is affected. So time to exhaustion increases with good sleep. So you're able to go further. You don't feel as tired until later on with good sleep, and more of the opposite with poor sleep. Hormones are affected. So growth hormone is released during deep sleep. We have testosterone that's being released. One study showed that a week of 5 hours in bed ended up reducing testosterone by 10 to 15%. So, which is the equivalent of a 24-year-old aging to that of a 40-year-old, you know, so this is huge.
Yeah.
Appetite hormones are regulated by sleep as well. With poor sleep, you'll see higher levels of ghrelin, so you'll feel more hungry, and lower levels of leptin, so you'll feel less full with poor sleep. In one study, they found less than 8 hours of sleep had almost a 2 times higher injury risk than those who were getting 8 or more hours. Another aspect has to do with immunity. So those who sleep less than 7 hours a night are 3 times more likely to catch a cold. And so that's an important aspect of getting good sleep as well, is being healthy, not being sick, and being able to be out there on the field and on the court.
Wow. Okay. So that's pretty convincing list of reasons to take sleep seriously if you want to take your exercise seriously. What's fascinating about all this stuff, all of this new research that's coming out, it's kind of turning a lot of things on their head. This specific topic we're talking about today, about exercise, I guess there used to be these attitudes of, let's say you were competing, train, and then, you know, sleep can suffer. But we've gone way past that idea now, haven't we? And I think it's becoming a lot more common these days, I see, with competitive athletes taking sleep as a real performance factor.
Absolutely. I think early on, there was kind of the attitude, I'll just get a little bit of sleep. I might get more training in, which will make me more productive. Kind of sleep fell to the wayside. And I think that was also related to the coach's inability to control what their players are doing on the off time, which I think is a challenge even now. But those people who aren't taking sleep seriously are really missing out on the most potent performance enhancing drug out there. And so teams are hiring sleep specialists. They are adjusting their spring training times. For example, the New York Yankees used to start at 8 a.m. They're now starting at noon. Teams are gathering electronic devices at night in order so that their players can get good recovery, good rest, not have the distractions of the phone. Even just a team recently, the Texas Tech Red Raiders, they're actually in the championship game of the National College Athletic Association basketball tournament. They actually gather all of their players' phones, put them in a bag, and they don't have access to them till the next morning. So it's really being taken seriously.
Okay, so we've mentioned these competitive athletes and sports people. Let's talk about someone who is just exercising. You know, they've got a day job. They're not a competitive athlete, but they just like to work out, whether it's going to the gym or going for a run or whatever. So one of the questions I see a lot is, when is the best time to have a workout? So let's just say you're working out once a day, whether that's going to the gym or going for a run. I know this is a huge topic, and there's research I see coming out all the time about this. And we'll talk about chronotype, which is the importance of our individual sleep preferences. But just this general topic about working out in the morning, working out in the afternoon, working out in the evening. I just wondered if you could give people just an idea about where we are in the scientific sort of literature on these topics.
Number one, I think whenever you can fit that workout in. So getting a workout in is better than not. So I think you start with the convenience of, when can I get that workout in? And actually, for those of you who think you don't have time for a workout, potentially even adding it into your commute. So can you maybe run home from work a few days per week, depending on where you're living? Can you take the stairs up to the 10th floor in your office? Just trying to find ways to fit exercise in is so important. If you have more of a flexibility, the recent literature has been showing that even a lot of times we hear evening exercise is bad for you, so you shouldn't exercise within an hour of bedtime. But what the recent research is showing is that evening exercise is fine as long as it's not that really high intensity, less than 1 hour before your bedtime is when that starts to become a problem. The other kind of area that is a little bit gray at this point, early morning exercise has somewhat of an impact on our nighttime sleep. So we're not getting quite as much as we should when that workout is early in the morning and lasting more than an hour. So as long as you're keeping that workout less than an hour, the research tends to show that that's okay. So I would say try and avoid the really high intense exercise late in the evening has been shown to be a problem right before bedtime. And then the early morning exercise lasting more than an hour has been shown to affect our sleep at night.
Okay. Could you explain the early morning impact? Because it kind of makes sense. You know, you're working out late at night and you're having a really intense workout and you're going to be wired before you go to bed. So that kind of makes sense. In the morning, you're saying keep it to less than an hour. What are the mechanisms that are going to impact on your sleep later in the day if you're having a really early workout?
Well, I think it has to do with, if I'm going to work out for more than an hour in the morning, it's likely that I have to be at work at a certain time. And so having that longer workout is kind of cutting into my nighttime sleep. If it's less than an hour, then you don't have to wake up quite as early and cut some of that sleep short.
There's also, I'm sure you saw this research come out recently, talking about different times of the day exercising, this impact on shifting the biological clock.
Yes.
This paper, it was very recent. It identified a couple of times during the day with regards to an optimal time. And I think it was about 7 a.m. they found a good time. And there was one, I think it's been 1 and 4 in the afternoon as well.
Yes. Very recent study that came out. Exciting, interesting results that they found. And they found that that 7 a.m. slot of exercise and then the 1 to 4 p.m. slot of exercise produced large phase advances greater than an hour. I read the details of this paper and I was really curious, you know, did they exercise in low light conditions? Because right. Could it be a factor of light right. that's impacting this? And they actually did exercise in low light conditions. So it's likely a factor of the exercise itself that's causing this phase advance. And so exercising at 7 a.m., exercising between 1 and 4 p.m. may help you to go to bed earlier if that's what you're after. They also found that exercising between 7 and 10 p.m. produced large phase delays. And so if you have to be to work at, you know, 8 a.m. in the morning, you may want to avoid that exercise between 7 and 10 p.m. because it's just going to potentially cause a phase delay, shifting your circadian rhythm later, shifting your melatonin rhythm later, so that you're not feeling tired until a later time, making it more difficult to fall asleep on time. So that's absolutely an important consideration to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I guess another thing, if you're going to a gym, let's say, and you choose that slot between 7 and 10 p.m., not only may you suffer these phase delays, but you're probably going to be in an environment like McDonald's with loads of strip lights. And so you've got the light in the later part of the day affecting your melatonin as well. So there's a double whammy there as well, potentially.
Yes, bright light can phase delay. So bright light can move our circadian rhythms later if it's at the wrong time. So that's why, you know, electronic devices aren't good for you right before bedtime, is because it's alerting your brain to wake up. It's reducing that melatonin.
So we've got some, you know, we've got some guidelines, but as I mentioned earlier, you know, essentially we're all individuals. We have this thing called chronotype, this idea that we all have inbuilt timings. What do we know about chronotype and exercise? Do certain chronotypes make people more suitable to different types of exercise at different times of day?
Mm-hmm. There's only been one study on this, to my knowledge, and it did find that those who were more evening types performed better in the afternoon versus those morning types performed better in the morning. So I think this is a really fascinating area. I think down the road, we may be able to recommend certain interventions for, let's say, a night owl who has to, you know, perform in the morning, potentially trying to shift their rhythm earlier. I think this is a very exciting and interesting area that will take quite a bit of time to where we can get to that point.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about different types of exercise. And I want to talk about this idea that possibly training harder is going to increase your need for having more sleep. And I want to relate this to the different types of exercise that people do. So let's say you're a runner, or let's say you're a weight trainer, or let's say you're going out and playing football. If you're training harder, you know, how does that affect your sleep?
Generally speaking, we think athletes need more sleep than a normal person who's not training, you know, 3 hours a day. Research has shown, for example, after a marathon, that you have more deep sleep and longer sleep to help recover from that type of event. with athletes such as LeBron James reporting to get 12 hours across a 24-hour day, Roger Federer, you know, 11, 12 hours, Michelle Wee, 10 to 12 hours. I would say the thinking right now is that athletes do need more sleep. But I just want to throw out a little study that I found, and people might think I'm a little bit crazy on this, but there was a study in rodents, so you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, that found that when the rodents were on the running wheel, while they're measuring their EEG, they were actually decreasing their sleep needs. So they found during that running exercise that night or that day for a rodent that they didn't have as deep a sleep. It was as if that repetitive activity was erasing some of that sleep need. And I think this is really interesting. And typically when you look at triathletes who are training, you know, they have to run, swim, bike, we find that they're sleeping the least. And I mean, part of that could have to do with the amount of training that they have. They just don't have enough time for a sleep opportunity. But maybe part of that repetitive activity is somehow reducing the sleep need. I was working with Dave Proctor, who prepared to run across Canada, doing over 100 kilometers a day for 66 days.
Oh my God.
And we studied him in the lab. And interestingly, he had very low levels of deep sleep. So I think this is an interesting avenue to explore. I would say the consensus right now is athletes do need more sleep. When they do get better sleep, they perform better. But maybe there's a caveat depending on the sport.
Fascinating. As with most things to do with sleep, we're still finding out a hell of a lot. I was hoping you were going to give me a neat little answer to tie things up there, Amy. But we like complexity. We like complexity. Another factor, you know, we know at night it's a time for cognitive processes to kick in, things like memory consolidation, learning motor skills and all that kind of stuff. So I guess that's going to be a factor if you're maybe a sports person as opposed to someone who's, you know, just lifting weights. What do we know about that, about how sleep can affect the fine tuning of these motor skills that are important in sport?
Well, we know in general population, so very controlled experimental studies, that learning a motor skill, you know, that REM sleep is really important. So we get the majority of our REM sleep towards the end of the night. And of course, we cycle through non-REM and REM throughout the night. But a big chunk of that REM is occurring at the end of the sleep period. And they find that when sleep is cut off, when you end up getting less REM sleep, memory consolidation can be affected and you're not quite as good on a motor performance task.
Okay, so there's a good reason there. Maybe that's another reason for not getting up at 4:30 in the morning to do your workout, because you need that REM, as you say. Okay, another topic. I know you're big on this one because I've seen you tweeting about this a lot. Napping. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, napping is huge. And a lot of athletes aren't really taking advantage of this. And even everyday people, it's been shown to reduce sleepiness, improve alertness, increase our concentration, and just kind of boost our productivity. And what we see in our Canadian national team athletes is that about a third of them aren't napping, and only about 20% are napping three or more times per week. So this is a huge area that we like to educate athletes on. So important. I think the duration of the nap kind of depends on what type of athlete you are. So for example, a swimmer who has to get up at 5 a.m, they're likely missing out on some of that nighttime sleep. So for that particular athlete, we would recommend taking a longer nap, more of that 90-100 minute nap, to make up for some of the lost sleep that they lost at night. if you're getting sufficient sleep, then more of that power nap would be ideal, 20 minutes or less, so that you're not waking up in the deepest stage of sleep where you're waking up feeling groggy. We have techniques that we'll give to the athletes to help them nap better. So just making sure their environment is like a cave, cool, dark, and quiet. Having techniques to help fall asleep. So potentially writing a to-do list prior to the nap to kind of offload those thoughts so that they're not thinking about what they have to do next. Incorporating breathing exercises, those types of things, is huge.
What about, let's just say a power nap, a short 20-minute nap. Let's say you go to the gym once a day, whatever, three times a week. Is there any guidelines of saying, you know, have your nap before or have your nap after that? Or is it more about just where you can fit it into your daily schedule?
With the shorter nap, I mean, you're getting into non-REM stage one, non-REM stage two. So it's more of an alertness boost, you know, shutting off some of those neurons. So that's the benefit of that short type of nap. You know, if you're trying to recover from, let's say, a really hard workout, then potentially taking a longer nap after that workout will help you get into some of those deeper stages of sleep where that growth hormone is going to be released, where tissues are going to be repaired. So more of that full cycle nap. And I kind of say that in air quotes because there's no recipe for, it's not exactly 90 minutes. Yeah. So in that instance, that's why we recommend not setting an alarm, you know, setting maybe a 2-hour emergency alarm, but trying to wake up naturally after that completed sleep cycle would be our recommendation.
That's good advice. I like that. I know we're skipping over these topics here, and I'm sure we'll go into these topics in more depth on later podcasts. And maybe if you're around, Amy, you can come back and talk about these in more depth. But I just want to give an overview of the different factors in this topic of exercise and sleep. You touched there briefly on this idea of recovery. It's a term people use quite a lot at the moment, this idea of stressing the body. So what actually is going on when we're sleeping and how is the body recovering?
Well, we are, you know, our breathing rate slows down, our parasympathetic nervous system is activated during sleep. So we have that stress response goes down with sleep. And as we cycle through the various sleep stages, so we start off with, you know, a light stage of sleep, non-REM stage one, cycle into stage two. And in particular for athletes, you know, we then are getting into the deeper stages of sleep, non-REM stage three, where, as I mentioned, growth hormone is released, tissues are being repaired. You know, muscles are being repaired, that kind of thing. And the majority of that non-REM sleep is occurring in those first two sleep cycles. And then we'll get into the REM sleep where memory consolidation takes place. So if you're learning a new skill or you're learning a new drill, a new play, you know, that type of sleep is important. I don't like to get too focused in on the sleep stages, just because in general, it's overall, you know, the amount of sleep that you're getting, but then also the quality of that sleep as well.
Couple more aspects here. Again, a huge one, diet. A lot of people who are focused on their exercise are also very focused on the types of food they eat.
Yes, many of our athletes are needing to fuel. So they might have a late night training session. It's pretty imperative for them to take in some calories after that training session. And so for us, we don't want that meal being a very heavy meal, spicy meal, lots of fats, lots of sugars, you know, because our body is trying to rest during sleep. And if you've just ate a large meal, all of the energy is going to go towards digesting that meal and not really be a restful state of sleep. So we would recommend more of that lighter meal, maybe, you know, with proteins and carbs, maybe half a turkey sandwich with some yogurt or something along those lines. Then you're able to rest during that sleep, but you're still getting some of those calories that you need. Right. We've had a number of athletes, you know, they've been pushed by the nutritionist, you know, you need this huge protein shake to recover from that workout. And many of them were having disturbed sleep because of that protein shake. So I think you really have to listen to your body. And, you know, if eating that protein shake is making me wake up in the middle of the night two times when I normally wouldn't, you know, you might forego that and try something a little bit lighter.
Okay, that's interesting. Maybe another instinctive thing that I've done a massive workout, I need to have a massive protein fest. But as you say, if that's late in the night, that's really going to impact your sleep.
Mm-hmm. It impacts the quality. So you might wake up more during the night. It could impact potentially sleep apnea. Many ENT sleep specialists tell you to stop eating 4 hours before bedtime, because when you eat before bedtime, those acids, you know, kind of get sucked up and can cause more sleep disordered breathing. That's another factor that can affect the quality. So ideally, if you can limit the eating prior to sleep and just keeping it light with proteins and carbs would be the recommendation.
Well, also related to this idea of diet, caffeine. I know that's something you're quite big on. You're a decaf advocate, and I must admit I do love my coffee. But I know you've done some work in this area. So, what are the implications of caffeine use and exercise, and how that obviously affects your sleep as well?
My take is to drink strategically, not automatically. That's kind of my tagline. I think even myself, I went to graduate school. I was drinking probably up to 3 cups a day, and it was automatic. You know, it was like, oh, I need my coffee. I feel like crap, you know, and so I would reach for the coffee again and again. And I knew before that I was sensitive to caffeine, but it with the continued use, you kind of don't even realize that anymore. And so I think the new research that is coming out is showing that your benefits from caffeine on exercise performance has to do with your metabolism of caffeine. So how fast of a metabolizer you are. And the recent work by Nancy Guest has shown that the fast metabolizers really benefit from caffeine. They do better. I mean, they do better on a time trial for a cycling test. But when she gave caffeine to the slow metabolizers, they actually performed worse. So this is a really exciting area. The benefits of caffeine may have to do with your genotype, depending on the exercise task that you're doing.
So how would you go about finding out if you're a fast or slow metabolizer? Is there any way to tell? Or maybe for one of those people who can have a coffee at 10 o'clock at night and you sleep fine, then I guess you'd be a fast metabolizer.
Well, interestingly, so my graduate work, my PhD work was with smokers trying to quit. And so we were trying to figure out whether sleep disturbance predicted relapse in smokers. And in this study, we allowed the smokers to have caffeine at any time. And so I had one individual who on the first night, he didn't use caffeine, and we looked at his sleep. And then it just so happened on the second night that he drank a cup of coffee right before bed. And he was telling me, you know, this does not impact my sleep whatsoever. Like, I can have a cup of coffee right before bed and it doesn't impact me. But when I looked at his sleep architecture, it was amazing the difference between the two conditions, I guess you could say, in that it took him longer to fall asleep by almost 20 minutes more with the caffeine. He woke up something like 22 times per hour. And we're talking not even being able to realize it. So we're talking, you know, maybe 1 second where his brainwave changed to an awake state and then went right back to sleep. So this was almost double the amount of times that he woke up when he wasn't having caffeine. And so I would challenge that a little bit, because you may think, oh, caffeine doesn't affect me. But in this instance, you know, it really showed that it did. Getting back to how do you know, I think the only true way to really know is to get a nutrigenomics test, which you can spit into a tube and, you know, and then they come back and tell you whether or not you're a fast, which is about 50% of the population, or a medium and slow, which is, you know, the other 50%. So taking that actual saliva test, but just understanding yourself. So for me, I haven't actually taken the test, but I just know that I'm really sensitive to caffeine. And so it's likely that I'm more of that slow metabolizer.
Right. Okay. So I was just going to ask you, are they related then, this idea of sensitivity to caffeine and how fast or slow you metabolize it?
Well, my friend, Nancy Guest, we were talking about this actually yesterday because she's from Toronto and I'm in Toronto. And she is very adamant that sensitivity is not metabolism. So I'm not quite sure how that relationship works. But in her mind, if I were to say I'm sensitive to caffeine, that's why I'm not performing well on this time trial test, she would argue that it's the way you metabolize caffeine, not necessarily your sensitivity.
Yeah. Okay. Well, last point here. I just wanted to see if you're a fan or an advocate of any of these gadgets, you know, people tracking their fitness and their activity and all that, but also people starting to monitor their sleep and to see how their sleep and the recovery is having an impact on their workouts the next day or over a longer period of time.
Yes, I worked with a semi-pro football team and they were looking into getting sleep monitoring devices. And one of the key points that they were interested in, I was working with the sports psychologist, and he was really curious, can you shut off the information so that the athletes aren't getting the feedback? And I think that's an important point. We don't want the watch to be telling us that we just got a poor night's sleep the night before a competition and I'm supposed to play in the Super Bowl, for example. So I think pro sports are trying to use objective monitoring of sleep, but trying to limit the information that the athletes are receiving back. And I think that applies to the general population as well. You have to be careful. Is the device validated? Has it been validated with polysomnography, the gold standard measurement of sleep? And can it really tell you how much deep sleep and REM sleep you're getting when you're not being hooked up to electrodes that are measuring your brainwaves? We have to be careful. And I can't even count the number of times that people have come to me and said, hey, my device is saying that I'm not getting good deep sleep. What do I need to do? And I probe further and I ask them, you know, they're getting the proper amounts of sleep. They feel great. So I don't think you have to do anything. And so I think the information can be hurtful in some circumstances. Yep. So as long as you're using it to motivate you to maybe get better sleep, but really take into consideration the quality of the information that you're getting.
Okay. Well, we've done a kind of a whirlwind overview of this subject. Is there any important points I've missed, Amy, or is there anything you want to sort of tag on to this discussion?
Well, one thing we didn't necessarily cover was sleep screening. So I helped develop the athlete sleep screening questionnaire, which is the only questionnaire validated in athletes to actually flag an athlete when they have a sleep problem, and then to kind of refer them to get help from a sleep specialist. And so if anyone out there is working with athletes, this tool is freely available. You can get it online. Maybe we can put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, you would just maybe Google Bender athlete sleep screening questionnaire and you're looking for the questionnaire in Sport Medicine Open. And then you go to that article, it's open access, freely available. And all you need to look for is the supplemental materials. And then you can download the questionnaire. It's a 15-item questionnaire, takes about 5 minutes to complete. And then based on those responses, we then have a classification system to where this athlete doesn't need sleep intervention. This athlete has a mild sleep problem. And then for those that are moderate to severe, would need further intervention from a sleep specialist. So that's a really freely available tool that people can access and use.
Great. Awesome. We'll definitely put the links on there. Thank you so much for your time. And maybe at some point in the future, we can come back and delve into some of these topics in a bit more depth, if you're up for it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jeff, for having me. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And your podcast is amazing. I think I've caught almost every single episode. And so keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate those kind words. I'll let you get on. I know you've got a busy schedule and you're doing talks and stuff, so I'll let you go on. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you. Take care.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And you can check us out on social, on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, and of course, on the website, sleepjunkies.com. See you on the next one.